The views and opinions expressed on this show belong solely to the hosts and their guests and do not reflect the views of any on-site institutions unless explicitly stated.
What's up, everybody? My name is Steve VanderWaal.
And I'm Justin Klosser.
And we're your hosts of Cannabis Cum Laude, a podcast devoted entirely to cannabis. We're going to talk cultivation, business, medicine, politics, culture, advocacy, and everything in between.
The cannabis industry is complicated. It's robust. It has a lot of moving parts. And it's our job to help you understand it just a little bit better. So tune in every week for a brand new episode. And if you have a question that you'd like answered on the show, send it on over to questions@cannabiscumlaude.com. Thanks. Enjoy the show.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Cannabis Cum Laude. And I'm very, very excited for this one. Today's guest is the Dr. Ethan Russo, who is a board-certified neurologist, psychopharmacology researcher, and founder and CEO of Credo Science. Previously, he was the director of research and development for the International Cannabis and Cannabinoids Institute in 2017 to 2019, the medical director of Phytex, and from 2003 to 2014, senior medical advisor. And he was a medical monitor study physician to GW Pharmaceuticals for numerous phase 1-3 clinical trials of the drugs Sativex and Epidiolex. He was a clinical neurologist in Missoula, Montana for 20 years. He has held faculty appointments in pharmaceutical sciences at the University of Montana and in medicine at the University of Washington. And he is the author and editor of 7 books and has published more than 50 peer review articles. Dr. Russo, thanks so much for joining the show today.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get started, I got to say it was your work, specifically taming THC and your work revolving around the Entourage Effect. That was what got me to get in the cannabis industry and start my company. My company is built on the notion of full spectrum wellness, and I appreciate you being a mentor from afar to me. It is a great honor to have you here today.
Yeah, well, thanks.
So today, as we're recording this, it is July 6th. Yeah, July 6th.
Yep.
5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And you just today released a groundbreaking study on the genetic basis of cannabis hyperemesis syndrome. Before we get into the study and kind of the nitty gritty of that, can you talk about, you know, what is cannabis hyperemesis syndrome at a high level?
Sure. So this is an enigmatic condition that was first reported in 2004 in Australia, but they trace this back to one fellow that had it in 1996. It's increasingly recognized now, but remains underdiagnosed. So this is a condition in which people who use high volumes of high THC cannabis will develop a constellation of symptoms where they have nausea, abdominal pain, vomiting, and then a very unusual behavior of taking prolonged hot showers or baths that reduce the symptoms. So this has been very resistant to treatment. The usual drugs for nausea, antiemetics, don't work. Rather, what works better is the drug haloperidol, Haldol, that's usually used to treat psychosis. And then a funny treatment, capsaicin, chili pepper extract on the skin. That creates a heat sensation, and that's what it has in common with the hot bathing. But heretofore, there wasn't an explanation for this. It's very clear that not everyone who uses a lot of cannabis gets this problem. So what sets these people apart? There have been theories about it, including that it was due to pesticide contamination, but that theory doesn't hold water. The symptoms of pesticide contamination or exposure to neem don't create these kinds of symptoms at all. And as someone who's had experience with organophosphate toxicity, something I saw in Phoenix in my residency, it's not at all the same. So there had to be something else. And we theorized that this could be due to some genetic susceptibility to people who have cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome, or CHS for short.
Um, I I kind of have a question there. The organic phosphate, I'm sorry, I'm going to jack it up. I lost the last word in my head.
Organophosphate, yep.
Yep, toxicity, is that what you said? And then, right. So that's from using biological products like neem or pesticides?
Yeah, pesticide okay. Contamination. But when somebody's been exposed to pesticides enough to get toxic symptoms, it's really a florid presentation that's life-threatening, and they end up in the intensive care unit and need atropine and other drugs. Even low-level exposure doesn't fit with these symptoms.
Okay. Sorry, as a cultivator, I'm curious about the use of pesticides, and honestly, most specifically, neem.
Yeah, no, I am very against the use of pesticides on cannabis, and have written about this previously. So it's one of those theories that became one of my pet peeves, that people would blame CHS on pesticide exposure. They are two very different things.
So what exactly is going on inside the body? Because typically we think of cannabis as something that is relieving for nausea and vomiting and things like that. So why is it that people with CHS end up with these symptoms that supposedly it's going to be preventing?
Yeah, that's the key question. We have a simple explanation, but the more complex explanation had eluded us up till now. So a lot of cannabinoids, particularly THC, tetrahydrocannabinol, have what's called a biphasic dose response. In plain language, that means that they can do one thing at a lower dose and the opposite thing at a very much higher dose. So it's absolutely true that low doses of THC help prevent nausea, particularly in association with chemotherapy for cancer. That's common knowledge. In fact, THC as Marinol was approved by the Food and Drug Administration in 1986 for that specific thing. However, at high doses, things flip, so that THC becomes pro-emetic. That's medicalese for provoking vomiting. But again, if this were true for everyone, why would CHS patients get to the point that any exposure to THC would produce this kind of unusual reaction? So we were looking for reasons. And as you can imagine, this is complicated. This involves a whole soup of chemicals in the body, neurotransmitters that affect the brain, affect the gut, whether one is going to vomit or not. So we wanted to look into why, and we actually found five mutations that distinguish CHS patients from high-volume cannabis users that didn't have the diagnosis. And these involved a number of different systems. One was TRPV1. That is the receptor in the body where capsaicin works and responds to heat. So that made some sense. We also wondered whether there could be a problem with how THC was processed in the body. In other words, how it was metabolized by the liver. And in fact, we saw a mutation again on an enzyme called CYP2C9. That's the main enzyme that breaks down THC. We also saw two mutations that relate to dopamine, another neurotransmitter, chemical messenger in the brain. This helped explain a number of things, because when you get too much dopamine, it produces compulsive behavior. And that can include the showers. It would also help explain an unfortunate fact, which is people with this diagnosis tend to have a tendency towards substance abuse in general. In other words, they use a great deal of cannabis and return to it, even though they get this terrible problem and end up in the hospital repeatedly. They always try to go back to the cannabis and have been resistant in many cases to the explanation that, look, the THC is what's making you sick. But unfortunately, a lot of these folks also have had problems with alcohol, tobacco, and other drugs, genetic susceptibility related to that. And then another one we weren't expecting, but showed up for sure. And it has to do with cholesterol metabolism. And unfortunately, it may place these people at risk for diseases later in life, such as Alzheimer's disease and diabetes and cardiac disease. So we don't know for sure that people who have this will develop that, but we're concerned that they may be at risk.
Now, obviously, the side effects of CHS are bad. But the side effects are not only are kind of one of two problems with this disease. And based on what I read from your PowerPoint in your paper, diagnosing this disease is there's kind of a lot of unknowns and it's kind of expensive. Can you talk a little bit about the process of diagnosing CHS?
Sure. So when someone presents to an emergency department this way, the tendency is to try and treat the nausea and vomiting. And again, conventional drugs like ondansetron and crinecerfont don't work well. And unless they know about the possibility of CHS, they wouldn't necessarily go on to haloperidol or applying the capsaicin ointment to the skin, which is going to be more effective. But additionally, they're going to want to evaluate the patient to make sure that they don't have an obstruction in their gut or other problem, tumor, or whatever it could be. So invariably, these folks get mega workups. They may have MRI scans, barium enemas, you name it. But because of the frequent delays in identifying this, which is known as a diagnosis of exclusion, you do all the tests, and if nothing shows up, eventually, hopefully, someone asks about your cannabis habits, and then maybe you get a diagnosis of CHS. But in the meantime, we've seen two figures on what people have spent to get to the point of diagnosis, and it's ranged from $26,000 to $96,000 before diagnosis. And the $96,000 was a 2012 figure. So it could be worse today if people aren't thinking about this. What we're finding is, although, again, this is considered uncommon, there have been 105 journal articles about it covering some hundreds of patients. But when I speak to emergency room physicians or gastroenterologists about it, they say, oh, sure, we see that a lot. And it's gotten to the point that they don't report it anymore. So one of the issues is, how common is this? How many people are really affected? And there isn't an obvious answer. But there are a lot of factors here because people aren't, even in this day and age, they may not be honest about their cannabis usage. There was a study that came out of Bellevue Hospital in New York City a few years ago. And they did a strange study where they looked at people who came in the emergency room not for cannabis and not for CHS and asked them about their cannabis usage. And then they asked about CHS symptoms, and they cut that number way down. But about a third of people who might have vomited in relation to cannabis use, they thought had CHS. And if they extrapolated that to the U.S. population, they think that 2.7 million people in the States could be affected. I think that's an overestimate, but even if it were only 1 million, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
And certainly something we want people to be aware of, particularly now that we have the opportunity to identify this, or at least the susceptibility to it with a screening test.
That was honestly my next follow-on. So these mutations that you found, you may have said it and I missed it. Were they found like all linked together, or were they like different mutations that were found just commonly amongst these people?
We didn't want to compare the CHS patients to anyone because we could have somebody that had a genetic susceptibility to CHS but didn't use cannabis. So we needed people who used a lot of cannabis, and average was like 4 grams a day. We're not talking about every once in a while. But again, statistically significant differences were seen in these five different genes. It is a situation where not everyone would have had all the mutations. We'd have to get bigger numbers to really identify which are the most likely to be associated, but this is going to be an ongoing process. But at least I'd say 4 of the 5 mutations that we found really fit very well and were sort of reasonable expectations. We really hope to investigate this further and find out more, particularly with respect to avenues towards treatment that might be more effective than what's currently done.
That's super important, especially to, I mean, I know I'm not the only one, but people like me who are pretty heavy daily consumers, to like all of a sudden to think that cannabis is your cure-all, essentially. I mean, for the most part, there's some things that it doesn't do, but generally I've had a much higher quality of life. But to think that that could someday potentially cause me to have a worse quality of life, or like significantly worse, is kind of scary to think about. And to know that you're making headway in the essence of like a screening test to go see if I'm more at risk for this or not, that's really, really exciting to me. And like, do you think that, so like, I personally am, I'm a medical patient as well. And so when with all of my doctors, I tell them, hey, I'm a medical patient, I'm a cannabis user. Do you think that if patients, listeners, people out here were to be more open with their doctors, because at the end of the day, they are bound by HIPAA rights and it's not going to get you in trouble. Do you think that medical professionals will be more likely to explore the CHS diagnosis quicker if they were given that information?
We sure hope so. Again, we hope that this testing, the genomic testing, which just involves a swab in the mouth, not even any blood, we hope that this would be utilized as a screening technique and maybe save some of that pain and suffering and the $96,000 before diagnosis. We really hope that this will be applied in a way that's going to be helpful to patients and the people taking care of them as well.
You know, something I think that's really strange about this illness is that it seems, and I know this because I know a couple people specifically that I'm connected with on LinkedIn who were cannabis users for their entire life, and all of a sudden, boom, cannabis turned on them, essentially. They started having these symptoms. How does it, if it's this, you know, kind of a genetic disorder, how does it just kind of seemingly come out of nowhere? You would think that the first time you use cannabis that you would start to show these symptoms. But I know a few people who've, you know, were lifelong consumers and all of a sudden they have CHS and they can't even touch it. Why does that happen?
Well, it's a great question. I can't say definitively, but one of the factors certainly would be the average increase in potency of cannabis. So there are a lot of people using high potency THC material. It's more freely available. It's not to say that it wasn't there in the olden days. It was, but the average has crept up steadily over time. Additionally, with the advent of concentrates and particularly vape pens, there's a greater susceptibility. CHS seems to be associated with the development of tolerance. In other words, when people escalate their intake of THC to try to attain the same level of high, it's possible then that they're going to trigger a CHS if they have an underlying susceptibility. Now, I want to go back to what Justin was saying for a second. We rarely see CHS develop in people who are solely using cannabis for medical purposes. And the reason would be that the doses are quite different. The amount of cannabis that someone needs to treat medical symptoms such as pain or sleeplessness or spasticity is very much lower than what people typically use when what they're aiming to do is be high. Not that being high is a bad thing, but like anything, too much of a good thing is a bad thing or can be a bad thing. So I would really make that distinction. And people who need cannabis medically should be judicious in their use. The best dose for medical treatment is the lowest dose that alleviates symptoms without the requirement to be high. So that would be the advice I'd give in those situations.
So this seems like it's, it's called cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, but it's really a THC syndrome, it seems like. Is this specific to Delta 8, Delta 9, and 11 hydroxy THC? Does it, how does that all work?
Sure. Most likely those three, the more intoxicating cannabinoids are the ones. We don't know about Delta 8. There's been all this hype about Delta 8. Delta 8 is a natural component. But there really haven't been scientific studies head-to-head comparing its potency to Delta 9. It may be that it's about two-thirds the potency of Delta 9. My suspicion is that it would, if someone had a high intake of Delta 8 THC, they would be at risk here. And certainly with 11-hydroxy THC, which is the primary breakdown product of THC, which is also psychoactive, that likely also places someone at risk. You can't really ingest THC without getting 11-hydroxy THC. Now, the real issue is if someone were using cannabidiol with no THC, could they avoid this problem? And the answer is maybe. We don't know. It's one of the questions we asked in our survey. Some people found that lower THC products, higher CBD products, they could get away with, but some could not. And in that instance, you have to wonder if it's the residual THC that may be present. And we don't always have good analyses of the products that are out there, particularly when someone buys CBD over the internet. My advice there is people should only be buying things where there's a certificate of analysis available, not on something that was tested 6 months ago, but the current batch that they're purchasing. That's an open question at this point. And if the question were, are there other cannabinoids that might help but not cause this problem? The answer is maybe, but again, this is something we need to investigate.
Yeah, it would be. I was thinking down that same rabbit hole there of like the CBG or even cannabinoid. Well, cannabinoid free, I would assume, is probably not going to give you an issue. But I'm curious the CBG.
There's another factor here. We know that people are set off that have this can be set off by smells, and it's probably what's called a conditioned response. You may know the story of Pavlov's dog. And you can teach a dog that you're going to ring a bell and they'll get food. And eventually they salivate to the bell even before there's no food present. And it could be that the smell of cannabis from the terpenoids can set someone off when they've developed the susceptibility to nausea and vomiting because they have CHS. So we can't rule out that there are going to be triggers that have nothing to do with the drug itself. The brain is a powerful thing, and people will say this is psychosomatic, but in fact, there's some biochemical change going on that's triggering these events for people who are susceptible.
You just triggered an interesting thought in my head of like, there's definitely a slew of people that I've met in my life who are like, I tried cannabis, that's not for me. I'm curious if they have these mutations or this increased maybe they just have like an even higher increased rate of, I don't know the word I'm looking for here, but like a risk of developing CHS, or like it's like instant for them. And they're just like, yep, nope, I don't want that.
Well, yes, and rarely there'll be people who try cannabis and get sick, meaning nauseated or vomit. And chances are they've had too much THC. They may be susceptible to it. Are they at risk for CHS? Maybe, but we don't always know. Again, if the THC is too much for that individual person, they could always get this pro-emetic nausea and vomiting response. The other reason that people try it and really don't like it and will never return to it is because they get anxious. And again, we can relate that to too much THC. So again, the advice is start low, go slow. And anybody who's turning someone on for the first time has to be really careful.
Yeah, even because, something like a one-to-one. Oops, sorry to cut you off there.
No, that's fine. You know, again, what the introducer may think is a good level of THC may be way too much for the uninitiated. So this is always the danger.
I had a kind of, before we get too far away from the topic, I had a follow-on question to the testing. Is that something that, like, if you're a heavy cannabis user and you just want to kind of make sure, like, before you take risk, like, maybe you could go get screened? Or is that something that once you started experiencing symptoms, it is used by medical professionals as a diagnostic tool?
Yeah, it could be either, but awesome. There will be a commercial test available from Endocana Health. Full disclosure, I'm on the scientific advisory board of this company. Probably in a couple of months. So we're in July 2021. We're expecting that by September, there'll be a commercial genomic test available from Endocana Health, and that will need to be ordered by a physician. Like a lot of things, it's probably not a good idea for people to try and do this on their own. They should have it ordered by their doctor. They should be able to have counseling in regards to the results that might appear. This is the kind of thing where it's not, an either or. You've got it or you don't. We want people to have full information and to be able to ask questions about it. So this has got to be done the right way.
Absolutely. Thank you for clearing that up.
Sure.
So I want to dive into kind of the meat and potatoes of the study. Can you talk a little bit about your methodology and your findings?
Sure. So we did this by an online survey, and it was mostly Americans, some Canadians, and a couple of Europeans that responded. We started off with 585 respondents, and some may have gotten there without really needing to be there. But we were extremely stringent about who we included in the analysis, the survey analysis. So we got down to 205 patients who had the full constellation of CHS, in other words, nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, and hot bathing behavior. Plus, they had to have ongoing symptoms, and they had to have a diagnosis from a medical professional. So there were likely people who had CHS but didn't fit all those criteria. Now, of the 205 that comprised the survey group with CHS, 99 of them, about half, agreed to have genetic testing done and were sent genomic test kits, but only 28 returned them. Now, that's not a great level of return, but people may have had second thoughts. While this was going on, there was a lot of publicity about law enforcement use of DNA. In other words, somebody's cousin had a genetic test and then they were arrested for sexual assault. Again, concerns came in. And plus, to be honest, This was publicized in the online CHS community, and there was a lot of pushback. There were people that questioned our motives or our methodology, and so there were people actually dissuading other folks from returning the kits. So this was a challenge. So we ended up with 28 people who had the testing who we were sure had CHS. And we tested them against 12 people who were heavy cannabis users that didn't have any of the symptoms at all, but equivalent levels of cannabis usage. And so that comprised the study group that went through the full genetic analysis. So yeah, we would have liked for the numbers to be better, but when you have statistically significant results that make sense with what we know about this disorder, I think it remains very valid. And again, this will be an ongoing investigation, we hope.
I'm curious, why do you think that people in the CHS community were so against it and kind of dissuading people from doing it?
Complicated, but it's fair to say that there's healthy skepticism among the CHS patients about what this is really about. If you know people who've had this, it's fair to say they're highly resistant to the idea that cannabis is what's making them sick.
It's funny. I have a friend of mine who I've brought up, not by name, of course, on the show, who has cyclic vomiting syndrome, who is a heavy, 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 heavy cannabis user. And, you know, years later, it still seems to come back once or twice a year. And my first thought is, I wonder if he has CHS. And
well,
there's a little bit of
denial.
It's
a great question. These are conditions that on the surface look to be the same, but they're not. Cyclic vomiting syndrome is something I used to see in my neurology practice. Most typically, this is going to start in a child. And it's episodes of nausea and vomiting unassociated with headache. But these are people that develop migraine later. And interestingly, cyclic vomiting syndrome can be diminished or eliminated by drugs used to treat migraine preventively. Now, to complicate matters, people who have cyclic vomiting syndrome have discovered that cannabis helps treat it. But in contrast to CHS, the cannabis does not make them sick, it makes them better. To make it more complicated, people who have cyclic vomiting sometimes feel better in hot water, but they're not in the shower or bath for hours and hours a day, is typical of CHS. And no one should think I'm making light of this. This is really dramatic behavior. It's what we call compulsive behavior. And unfortunately, it's often the only kind of first aid that the CHS patient can do short of going to the hospital. So it's really a desperate situation for these folks. But with close questioning, it should be possible to distinguish the two conditions, CVS and CHS. But yeah, there's going to be confusion about these differences.
So is there a treatment or a cure for, I don't know if cure is the right answer, but is there like a treatment that people could use that maybe lessens this scenario because they're so dead set on consuming cannabis that they're just not going to change their ways? In contrast, is there people who have cut their use and still experience symptoms?
Yeah. Well, you know, how long it takes before abstinence allows somebody to reduce their symptomatology varies. For some people, it's days. There are people that have had residual symptoms for weeks. But what typically happens is someone may stop using cannabis for a while, and they could go weeks or months later and resume. Initially, they may be okay, but typically, once they develop tolerance again, they often will trigger a new cycle. We hear about this repeatedly. So otherwise, what can people do? Well, we're not sure all the factors yet. But additionally, we know from talking to people with this, a lot of them have other habits that could be factors. Alcohol use, diets that aren't always so great. Could diet, better diet help prevent it? Maybe, but we don't know yet. But these are the kinds of things that we'd like to explore.
That's a side effect that a lot of us know about, but don't necessarily like to advertise, is the reduction of quality in diet that typically follows cannabis consumption. It's those munchies with some people have a tendency to lead towards the candy and chips and all the things that you don't want. And if you don't get that under control, you're probably compounding the issue.
Yeah, and the problem with junk food is it tends to be beyond being high in sugar and salt, is that it tends to be pro-inflammatory. And inflammation is going to worsen any condition, including this type of condition.
Interesting. I was absolutely ignorant to that. So now I know that when I'm having some issues, I probably should lay off the junk food, because unfortunately I do have a sweet tooth.
I have a quick question about that. While we're on the topic of like treatments, so being in the natural products business, you know, I've kind of taken my love for cannabis and my newfound knowledge of non-cannabis botanical and herbal medicine and have started looking at the ways that they combine and synergize. You know, and you said earlier that capsaicin, which comes from hot pepper extract, seems to be an alleviating natural treatment. Why? What about the way that substance interacts with the body would, do you know? I'm very curious. Yep. I'm always looking at, you know, stuff like that.
So capsaicin is what's known as an agonist and desensitizer at the TRPV1 receptor. Let's break that down. Okay, so an agonist is something that stimulates a receptor. TRPV1 is a receptor that relates to high temperature, low pH, and it has to do with pain responses, and that includes the gut. It also works in pathways in the brain related to nausea. Now, the interesting thing about capsaicin is, people are vomiting. They're not going to be able to eat anyway, but eating hot food isn't going to be helpful in this instance, because capsaicin isn't well absorbed in the gut. It actually is better absorbed in the skin. It can get through the skin and into the bloodstream and presumably to the gut and to the brain and help. But eating hot food isn't going to be adequate in this instance, if anybody can even do it.
Yeah, I can't imagine if I had an episode of CHS, I'd be eating some jalapenos or probably be looking for something quite the opposite.
That was like a light bulb in my head, though, when you said that it's more absorbable through the skin. Because like if you cut a pepper or something of that nature, or not to be crude, but anybody who's ever been maybe cooking and realized they had to run to the bathroom quick probably hasn't experienced a bad time.
Yeah.
And that is, I don't know, it just bing there. Sorry.
That's
all true.
So thank you for sharing that about the paper. I'm excited to see, you know, what comes from that in terms of diagnostics. And if we start to realize that many more people have this syndrome, because let's be honest, as an advocate, you know, we've all heard people say cannabis is perfectly healthy, there's no issues, blah, blah, blah. And the reality is, and like you said earlier, too much of a good thing is a bad thing. And I think that, as you know, our purpose of the show is to talk about some of these hard truths that the industry doesn't really like to talk about. We're a very, very protective industry. And to some cases, a lot of us in the industry are in denial because we want to, you know, accept the fact that cannabis is perfect, and it's not. It can be in moderation, but some people, if you're genetically predisposed, it may not be a good option for you. But it is good that we have these tough conversations, because if we're going to be taken serious as a legitimate industry, because we are, These are the conversations that need to be had. So thank you for bringing this to light. I want to talk a little bit about kind of what you're doing right now. What is Credo Science and what is the company's mission?
Sure. Well, I appreciate your asking. So we started this company in March of 2020, and we're what's known as an intellectual property holding company, meaning that we have ideas that we think need to be developed related to cannabis and the endocannabinoid system. So our first big breakthrough is probably this study about cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome, but we have another study where we're going to get the results in the next several weeks, another diagnostic test for a much more common condition that we feel is related to problems in the endocannabinoid system, so we'll see. We have some nutritional supplements we're working on that will be anti-inflammatory, that have nothing to do with the cannabinoids, but still derived from the plant. We also have a formulation service that we offer to the natural products industry and the pharmaceutical industry. One of my sayings is that we want to make cannabis safer and better. I also feel that most of the studies that have been done clinically with cannabis have not utilized optimized preparations. In other words, they might have helped, but they weren't as good as they could have been based on the components that were present. So this has always been one of my missions, is to get the right preparation for a given condition.
Yeah, I don't know to what extent, you know, we kind of know each other through Dr. Harold Smith and that medical cannabis event we did last year. I don't know if you've spoken with him today. I was just meeting with him today. He gave me a tour of Cannametrics. They've got funding. They've made some big breakthroughs right now in regards of dose dependency and EC50 stuff. And I feel like there could be maybe a future collaborative effort between Cannametrics and Credo, because they're both doing some really groundbreaking stuff that the industry so desperately needs. You know, what's kind of on the forefront for, you know, what are you most excited and looking forward to studying in the near future?
Well, again, we're really looking to expand the range of treatments for a variety of conditions with our formulations. And we have a couple of arrangements in place with companies that are rolling out products that people may use to treat a variety of common conditions. Yeah, I don't want to give too much away because some of these aren't available yet, but that is our basic mission, to increase consciousness of the endocannabinoid system and how it can be leveraged towards better health.
Absolutely, Admiral. And then speaking of the endocannabinoid system, another company that you're a part of, Phytex, has a really, really awesome virtual tour on the website. And you get to go through and kind of learn how the endocannabinoid system works, and we'll drop that link in the show notes for you viewers to be able to check out, because I was looking at that the other day. It was absolutely, it was just awesome.
It's with Phytex at the beginning, but have been gone for a few years now.
I'm sorry. I apologize for that. I saw that on your LinkedIn, and then I apparently didn't connect the dots that was no longer a thing. I apologize for that, Dr. Russo.
It's fine.
So obviously, you know, we talked at the beginning about your work in the realm of, you know, cannabis synergy and the entourage effect, you know, the idea that all of the chemistries in the cannabis plant work better therapeutically than broad spectrum or isolates. You know, you have done some work with GW and products like Sativex and Epidiolex, which are not full spectrum products. How did you kind of manage your work in knowing that, you know, full spectrum really is the way to go, and doing work with products that are, they are isolates, right? CBD and THC isolates. Did you find yourself having like any inner conflicts?
Yeah, perhaps.
Yeah.
Let me expound a little bit on that. Epidiolex is 97% pure CBD. Now, if I'm going to be honest, there's a lot of evidence that CBD, although it's a good anticonvulsant, requires very high doses. And we know from a meta-analysis that was done by Pamplona et al. That people are claiming equivalent efficacy in treating severe epilepsy with doses about 20% of the dose of CBD alone. In other words, as an extract, you can use a much lower dose because additional components, whether some of the other cannabinoids or terpenoids, also contribute to the anticonvulsant effect, the effect to reduce seizures. Now, in contrast, Sativex, which isn't available in the United States, but is approved in 30 countries, is got more components. That is derived from the plant, as Epidiolex is. It's not as refined. What they did was combine extracts from a high THC variety and a high CBD variety. There are some terpenoids in there. I think that although that's a very good medicine for some conditions, I think that in specific instances, we could do better with an extract that might have more components in higher concentrations. So that's what I'll say.
Fair enough.
Definitely. I have a little bit of a personal question, kind of relates to CHS. It's always felt to me like if you take a tolerance break or something, that once you start consuming, that tolerance builds back up faster. Is that a real thing, or am I kind of making that up in my head? Is the endocannabinoid system kind of snap back into place, like muscle memory almost?
Yeah, it may. And it's going to vary for each individual. There's a concept that we call endocannabinoid tone. This is a function of how many receptors there are, the CB1 receptor in the brain, whether they're active or inactive, what's the activity of the enzymes that make the endocannabinoids and break them down. And that none of these things are things that we can measure very freely in the living patient at this time. The technology isn't there yet. But it is true that when people take a break, the system readjusts and they'll be more sensitive upon resumption. But how long that lasts really is going to be a function of how much people push the THC dosage. Mm. My colleague Dustin Sulak has what he calls a resensitization procedure. If he's seeing someone medically and they're using great amounts of cannabis, he'll have them quit for 48 hours and then resume at half the dose they were using before. And usually, and this is what's so funny, we would think it would take longer, but usually they get the same benefit on treating their symptoms with half the dose. If they took a longer break, maybe it would be even less. But again, people make a mistake when they're dosing cannabis to treat symptoms to the point of being high. The strategy should be different. It should be, I'm going to take enough to reduce my pain or my restless legs or whatever the symptom is, and that's where you stop. Yeah. So again, I'm not going to say that being high is a bad thing or a side effect. It's considered that by the FDA, though. But the best dose is the lowest dose that treats the symptoms without the necessity of intoxication.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I think the industry right now, obviously it's a new nascent industry, and we are naturally an overconsumptuous society, and the industry right now is geared towards potency. You know, which from a cultivation perspective, you know, especially some of these growers pulling 33-34% THC out of a plant is amazing, right? But now you start introducing these extracts and, you know, everyone, Now, and I used to be guilty of this too. Going to the dispensary. What's the most potent thing you got? That's not really, you got to have a respect for it. Okay. But I think people need to realize, A, you need to look for what fits you, learn how to read a COA, learn and understand what terpenes are in and how they work. Because when you understand, you know, this type of information, it'll be a lot easier to find a cannabis product that's suited for you. Is some more potent stuff, you know, more suitable for others? Sure, probably. But we definitely need to get away from this more is better ideology when it comes to cannabis and start looking at is like, what are all the secondary cannabinoids? You know, is it a moderate amount of THC? What are the terpenes? And I think when we do that, we'll, you know, more and more people, especially people who may have had a bad experience with cannabis, will start to realize, wow, there is a cannabis product for me.
Exactly. So, you know, I think when someone goes into a dispensary, the question they should be asked is, what is the effect that you're seeking? You know, when, it is a typical experience that someone will come in and they ask for the highest potency THC available. But again, they should be more interested in the condition that they're trying to treat or the effect that they want to achieve. And that may come from high potency THC, but it's more likely that they're going to have a better experience with a more balanced preparation, particularly with other cannabinoids included and a broad range of terpenoids. One example, if someone has chronic pain, THC helps, but it also helps a great deal to have CBD there, at least as much, maybe even more CBD. And if they're going to work or study, they need to have something that's going to reduce the side effects of THC, particularly alpha-pinene, that's going to reduce or eliminate the short-term memory impairment that THC produces so that they can function rather than be couch-locked if they have too high THC with too high myrcene. So these are the fine points that wouldn't be evident without the right education or the availability of certificates of analysis that are going to inform the consumer about what they're buying.
So where is there anywhere that you would recommend that maybe our listeners would go to find reliable information on how these terpenes work? I mean, obviously that was a silly question. Probably go to Credo Science and figure out how some of that works. I apologize leading the other way, but there's a million things on Google, right? And they could all be, any Joe Schmo can throw something on Google.
Yeah. If people want information from our website, they can go to ethanrusso.org. That's my personal website. It's got all of my writings, and I'd aim them at two in particular. One is Taming THC, the paper from 2011 that talks about cannabinoids and terpenoids. And another would be the article that I wrote with Caroline McCollum on dosing and administration. Give people guidelines on how they should approach their dosing, what they should aim for. So I hope that those would be helpful. And then there are a lot of other good resources. Healer.com, run by Dustin Sulak, who's just come out with a great book, but really for clinicians. Two books by Bonnie Goldstein, and the book Cannabis Pharmacy by Michael Backus. All of these are really great resources. Every year there are more books. But for free content, people can go to ethanrusso.org.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you very much. And we'll make sure that we post that in the episode notes and on our social media platforms this week as we prepare to launch the episode on Friday. This does come to about the end of our show today. Thank you so much for the time. I know it's been crazy. You literally published a paper today, a groundbreaking paper nonetheless. We surely appreciate your time and everything you're doing with the industry. And we hope that you'll come on the show again and keep us up to date on what you're doing. Thanks again.
Chance, it was a pleasure.
Yes, thank you so much, Dr. Russo. And listeners, don't forget to elevate your state of mind.
We'll see you next week. thanks to our friends here at Rockbox Recording and Production in Rochester, New York. They are a full professional podcast and video studio designed by a radio guy for podcasters. Audio, video, voiceovers, editing, whatever. Mouth off at Rockbox at rockbox.com.
You can follow Cannabis Cum Laude on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Cannabis. Type Cannabis Cum Laude into your search bar and you should be able to find us, but the links will also be posted in the episode notes as well. If you want to help support the show, head on over to Patreon, and that will ensure that we're able to keep the best quality sound and video coming to you on a regular basis. And if you liked what you heard today, please don't forget to rate and review the show.